Last year, Adam and I and a few hundred friends of DeSoto gathered in the Masonic Lodge inside a cemetery in the heart of Hollywood. Were we there to practice some dark rite? Some sinister ritual designed to bring deceased Star Trek actors back to the plane of the living? To bring an unholy horde of undead nerd celebrities to Earth to consume the brains of the living? No, we were just doing our live show of the Share Your Embarrassment Tour. It's our review of Star Trek V, and we filmed it. We just wanted to let you know to get ready for that live stream announcement coming next week. If you're a Max Fun member and you support our shows, you'll get access to discounted tickets from membership at MaximumFun.org. So, good time to make sure those emails are delivering properly to your inbox. Either way, we'll be announcing ticket links soon here and on our mailing list that you can sign up for at podshop.biz. The Share Your Embarrassment Tour is coming to your living room for one last stop, and you're not going to want to miss it.
Captain?
Not here.
Captain?
Report.
Signatures detected.
Shields up.
Signatures detected.
Red alert.
Context Starfleet Command.
What's happened?
Context Starfleet Command.
Delay that order.
Context Starfleet Command.
This is the captain.
Context Starfleet Command.
Get out of my chair. Chair.
We have engaged the Klingons.
Klingons? Klingons.
Welcome to The Greatest Discovery. It's a Star Trek Discovery podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica. I feel compelled to like start with a flashback to the first episode of The Greatest Generation. But I can't even remember it. It was so long ago. The special unaired episodes that we recorded as a test.
Did we ever do that? My memory is that we put out the first episode we ever recorded together.
We did. That was a terrible idea.
Yeah, we should not have done that.
I really feel bad for all of the people that Greatest Gen was recommended to if they started at the beginning and thought that's what we were.
Yeah, yeah.
We got a whole lot better, I think.
You know, debatable. Some might say we got worse.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a fairly recent opinion.
It's been a hell of a run, though. The idea of a flashback is very interesting to me because, like, I had this, something kind of hit me this week. We're recording this the Friday before this episode comes out. So all week long, people have been tweeting at us like, oh, you guys have got to watch the TOS episodes that are referenced by this upcoming episode of Disco. Like, you're not going to understand it. You're not going to get it. And all week I've been just ignoring those tweets and Reddit messages and whatnot. Just smug that, you know, like, I know how to review Star Trek and I don't need to go back and get information to make everything make sense to me. Like, if the writers and showrunners of Discovery are going to put out an episode that I can't understand if I haven't seen a 60-year-old TV show, that's on them, not on me. And then I realized that we kind of ask the same thing of anybody that listens to any of our shows. Like, if you haven't listened to all 290 episodes of Greatest Gen and Greatest Discovery, there's a good chance that one of our dumb inside jokes We'll miss you.
Well, I mean, you're on your own if you choose to listen to our show.
You're not, though, because we have like we have a Wikia. There's the Wikia Greatest Gen page, and it's like Memory Alpha, but for Ben and Adam.
I completely agreed and agree with you about that point. I think it would have been a terrible misstep for this show to depend on a viewer's viewing history to understand. Like, and not only that, but as you said, 60-year-old viewing history to understand what's happening here.
Yeah. Is it 70 years? How long ago was that show?
I mean, it's like the way war veterans have been dying off over the years. Like, you rarely find someone who's seen the original series Star Trek still alive. It's that old.
And the people that are still alive, like, really just decrepit beyond belief at this point.
Yeah. Eating very early breakfast at diners. Ben, I kind of want to get started. We're doing all this flashback talk.
Let's just get into it.
Yeah, let's get into Star Trek Discovery Season 2, Episode 8, if memory serves. Brandon Bird, friend of the show, tweeted about this show open in a really fun way.
Yeah, fine artist Brandon Bird, who painted the tour poster for Greatest Gen Con.
He asked if this was a bit. And I love that idea. It is, isn't it?
I think it's kind of a bit. I mean, I think it was a very fun idea, and I thought it was well done. Nice to see them, you know, have a little levity about the idea that that show and this show share any DNA. But also, I don't think it's necessary. Like, I don't think that you need the little roll in previously on Star Trek with the original series footage to get this episode.
I mean, I agree with you up to the point of Vina's repeated appearances in the ep. Like, to fully understand her pathos, I think this pre-roll is pretty useful. Also, does Jeffrey Hunter get royalties from that?
Oh.
Or the estate of Jeffrey Hunter, I should say?
I don't know. Is that who
that's who played O.G. Pike.
Oh. I wouldn't be surprised. That might be something that expires upon your death, though.
It's strange how, like, we both knew what O.G. Pike looked like, but until you cross-cut between Jeffrey Hunter and the Pike we have today, like, I really understand the casting a lot better. Like, there is a definite resemblance that I didn't really get. I didn't really grasp that before the direct cross-cut.
Yeah. I feel very fortunate that they chose not to Benjamin Button him to look a little bit more like. that was a good choice by them, and probably also much cheaper.
Yeah,
he's a little grayer in Disco, but I guess that's appropriate, right?
Right. Yeah. The point of this pre-roll is that shit has gone down, and Pike knows all about the Talosians and things that happen on Talos IV.
And he also has kind of a squeeze on Talos.
Yeah.
Are you real?
Perhaps they made me out of dreams you've forgotten.
I thought, Adam, given the degree to which a planet called Talos is part of this show and the extensive use of ultra wide angle lenses, that it's a shame that they didn't get Yorgos Lanthimos to direct this one.
Because
then you could have called the episode Yorgos Lanthimos Goes to Talos.
Real missed opportunity there, Ben.
Just a thought I had. You know, he comes fresh off of his, Oscar wins for The Favorite.
Yeah. I love that movie.
That was a great movie.
The warped mind behind The Lobster.
I never saw that. Should I see it?
Oh, you got to see The Lobster.
Okay. I read the description, and it just sounded so dumb.
Oh, no. No. I mean, you have to suspend one main bit of disbelief, and I have faith that you could do that. You were a jazz gummy away from that amount of belief suspension.
Wow. all right. Well, maybe I'll do that this evening. anyways, we actually do get a captain's personal log in this episode. And it's about how much Pike hopes that Spock and Michael Burnham don't fall into the clutches of the dastardly Section 31. Smash cut to
the dastardly Section 31.
Yeah. The aftermath of the Michael Burnham Spock escape, where Captain Leland has kind of been called on the carpet by a gaggle of multiracial Starfleet admirals. We've got a Vulcan admiral. We've got I think there was a human in the background. He might have been Vulcan. I didn't get a great look at him. But what are the other guys? Andorians and Tuskmen?
Yeah, there's a Tuskman there.
Yeah.
You can tell by the much larger collar needed for the Tuskman. This is a setup for a Star Trek joke, isn't it? This Section 31 McLaughlin group.
Four admirals walk into a bar.
Yeah. The bartender asks, why the long tusk?
Why the long antenna?
Yeah.
So yeah, Leland has got to eat a plate of shit because the people that he was tasked with finding and apprehending have escaped off his ship, and this is not a great look for him.
They're doing good work with Leland because he is most definitely in the ball kicking machine, but he's not complaining. Like, he is struggling against it, and I think that's crucial.
Yeah, well, they gave him that rolled up piece of rawhide to put between his teeth.
Trust me, son, this helps.
Take it from me, Giorgio says to him.
Yeah.
She comes from a time and place with a much more advanced ball-kicking technology.
Yeah. Ball agonizer technology is what she's used to.
They also drop that Burnham is considered to be guilty of yet another act of mutiny in the eyes of the Admiralty, which is a pretty interesting ripple that I didn't really see. I don't see that paying off for at least a few episodes at this point.
Are you aware of a Federation-wide three mutinies you're out rule?
Well, a lot of federations passed those kinds of laws in like the 80s and early 90s.
Yeah, you get a lot of nonviolent mutineers serving life sentences, Ben. That's no good.
And just because somebody like somebody can commit mutiny and then serve their debt to society, but then their voting rights are taken away, that's fucking preposterous. Is the punishment the punishment, or is the punishment not the entire punishment?
I don't know.
You overlook the unpleasant alternative of punishment.
We cut from the further diminishment of Leland to Georgiou's FaceTime with Pike and Ash Tyler.
I mean, Leland tells her to, like, basically give Discovery something other to do than look for Spock, because they're sending out the APB to all of the rest of the ships in the Federation. Man, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the conflict between Georgiou and Leland, because I feel like it's a bit of like a whoever wins, we lose. Like, do we want either of them to win this conflict?
It's a fascinating question to consider, but there's so much happening in these episodes that don't serve that question as much as, like, why does Leland listen to Georgiou? Who is interested in Georgiou being in the position that she's in, if not Leland? And if Leland was the person who made that call, why doesn't he make another call that's like, you're fired?
Yeah, beam her into space. Like, she doesn't belong in this universe anyway.
If Leland had hiring control, he has firing control. And why would he allow her to be around if all she does is compromise him?
Like, there is an argument to be made that she, like, saved the cat when she gave Michael Burnham an opportunity to kick her ass a little bit and then escape. But then, like, you know, this scene where she is giving Pike and Ash Tyler the order to, like, figure out what happened to that probe and recover the wreckage of the shuttlecraft, like, she's lying to both of them in that scene also. And it's like, who does this benefit? It benefits her. She's up to something.
It doesn't seem like it should be possible for Georgiou to be navigating her situation as well as she is.
Yeah, she seems like she knows so much.
We need to know why this benefits Leland, because it just doesn't.
Yeah, like this has been a terrible deal for Leland from the second he recruited her.
It's way past fucking time to explain this, too.
Yeah, I think an episode from, like, in the last, like, three or four kind of got squished in there in a way that has made this uncomfortable.
They Mr. Belvedere'd?
Yeah.
Episode 5.
Well, I'm just saying, like, it seems like the order of operations is a little out of whack. And another example of that is when we catch up with Stamets and Culber. Like, this is, like, the thing we have been waiting for since the episode where Culber got reconstituted out of alien pod. And I feel like this is like three or four episodes on now that we're finally right. getting to his experience of returning.
It really makes me wonder how they break these episodes individually. Like, are they columnating these episodes in acts and callbacks? Because it would lead me to believe that they're not doing it that way and instead are very focused on a story shit, and then if there's time, what are the things we can carry forward with us? Like, what do we have room in the bag for?
Yeah, but they're also like getting distracted about which story is the A story.
Yeah.
You know,
my senses, my feelings don't connect with it.
The feeling I get from Culber is that he is really angry, like, and doesn't even know at what yet. I mean, I kind of imagine that is from the feeling of abandonment that he must have experienced living in the mycelial forest for as long as he did. It doesn't seem like he is able to let that drop. And this first scene that we see them, we also see him clock Ash Tyler walking down the hallway. And that is a really insane thing to imagine having to live with, like somebody that like actually murdered you. you have to share a ship with.
I love that Stamets expresses the incredulity about them being ordered to live on the same deck on the ship. Like, yeah, no one else in USS Discovery HR realized that might be a bad idea.
Why isn't Ensign Hospitality on this?
Yeah. Wilson Cruz, as a person, just has naturally kind eyes, I feel like. He has, like, resting, kind face.
Yeah.
And I mean that as a compliment. And I also mean that as a way to say that when he is angry or upset looking, it is really scary to see him walk around with like permanently furrowed anger brow, knowing that there is a jacked person below the black zip up that he's wearing. Like hospital jacked Wilson Cruz is ready to fight.
Yeah, this pot might boil over.
Yeah.
My film studies antenna went up when I saw him in the black garment that he wears this entire episode as being the exact opposite of his white Starfleet medical uniform that we're used to seeing him in.
That's a great paper, Ben. Great paper. Turned in on time.
Solid A-. Kind of right there on the surface, but well written and very few grammatical errors.
You wrote that 8-pager the night before. Couldn't tell the difference.
Your bibliography was perfectly formatted.
Yeah.
At the end of the last episode, Michael Burnham and Spock were headed to Talos IV, and they're on their way there when they come out of warp, and it's a black hole, and Michael Burnham is scrambling to like pull up and get them out of harm's way, and Spock kind of like restrains her in her seat and shoves the accelerator back down and points their nose right into the black hole. But it turns out it was a trick black hole. Really at Talos IV. It was all an illusion.
Yeah, Spock seems to have come to at a useful time, right? Spock being catatonic for basically the entire journey.
Yeah. He pulls it together just enough to get them down to Talos IV.
The surface of Talos IV looks a lot like the encampment playset from Harlac, which, coincidentally enough, was the episode of Season 1 that T.J. Scott also directed.
That, really?
Yeah, when Michael Burnham goes and visits that compound there.
Yeah. I imagine there is like a quarry somewhere outside of Toronto that you can go rent.
Yeah.
T.J. Scott was a stuntman before he was a director, and I read that after watching the episode, but in talking about it with you, I want to think about like what scenes that might have informed.
Yeah, I sure would have assumed he had directed the last episode, given the number of stunts and fights in that one.
Well, while Michael Burnham is up kind of getting the lay of the land, a blonde lady shows up in the vicinity of the shuttlecraft and heads in to talk to Spock. Michael Burnham holds her up with a phaser. We come to know that this is Vina. And she already knows Spock because he previously visited this planet.
Yeah, and we kind of already know that a bit from that pre-roll.
Right. I mean, I think that, you know, having it necessary to recast Spock and Vina because almost 100 years have transpired in between now and when that original episode was shot, like, they do have to, like, name check everything in this scene.
These original series viewers are dying, Ben, and you continue to make fun of them. How dare you? The story that Vina tells is that her ship crashed on Talos IV, and then the Talosians put her back together. And then she lets that line just kind of hang in the air a little bit.
Yeah.
Totally unquestioned by Michael Burnham.
Gotcha, gotcha. Now, if you're going to build a beautiful young woman named Vina,
you're going to want to make her breasts a priority.
Jesus. She's going to wear very high-heeled shoes despite the rocky environment because this is the 60s and that's what women wear.
We're going for form and not function. Yeah, and Spock seems to be familiar with her as well, even though he is half cat at this point.
Yeah.
She relays a message to them from the Talosians, and that message is, hey, we want to meet. Why don't you beam below the surface and we can do that? And so they do.
Down they beam. And the deal that they pitch is basically this. Like, we can figure out what's going on with Spock. His brain has like gone outside of linear time, and he's now experiencing time as a fluid, and he is just logically ill-equipped to deal with that.
The Talosians are like, we've given him a bunch of orange juice. We've rubbed his back. I mean, what else is there that we can do?
He's just going to have to sleep it off. But for the use of this cot, we require a price.
We should interrogate this a little bit, right? The idea that in exchange for the repair job, the Talosians want to feel their pain.
Yeah. It is very obviously reminiscent of Star Trek V,
mm-hmm.
The idea of feeling your pain. Spock has a beard, just like Cybok. This is all a bunch of flashbacks to Spock and Michael Burnham's childhood, and Cybok does not enter into this at all. Does Cybok not exist suddenly?
The Talosians, unlike Cybok, though, aren't doing this to benefit you. At no point do they express that that's the reason. They're doing it for them. Like, the price extracted is to benefit them.
They're just pain edgelords?
Yeah. It really seems that way.
They're like rubbing their nipples going, show me your pain. Oh.
The Vina character does a great job here in really low-keying how you really
do not... I'm a messy bitch and I love drama and I want to see your pain.
The Talosians like get under a glass table and they're like...
Dump your pain on this. Oh!
The Talosians are pain freaks.
Yeah, that if you could put your pain on your feet, oh, that would be so hot.
I really like Vina in this scene and a few others because she makes some pretty thinly veiled comments about how unpleasant it is to resist what the Talosians want.
Yeah.
And this is one of those scenes where she's like, it would be better for you if you agreed to their terms, and then kind of stares off into the middle distance like, holy shit. Like,
yeah,
I believe her. I believe her deeply. And Melissa George is the person who plays Vina, and I think she's great in this episode at that. It doesn't feel like she gets pages and pages of dialogue, but what she gets is a lot of look acting, and
yeah.
I think she's great with it.
She does a great job. I looked her up on IMDb when I saw how much she was doing with such a small part.
Yeah.
I thought she really caught my eye.
Feels as real as it looks.
So the deal back on the Discovery is that they're supposed to be like getting to the bottom of what happened to the shuttle that Pike flew into the time butthole. And Ash Tyler like saunters onto the bridge and is like, how are we doing with the shuttle investigation? But overhears some work being done on the on trying to get to the bottom of Spock and Michael Burnham's location. And he's like, hey, Pike, what gives, dude? Like, what the hell do you even think you're doing?
I love how grounded this scene and this moment is in common sense, right? Like, yeah. The Discovery is a science ship. It is best equipped to do recovery of something like a exploded shuttle pod. It's probably less suited to a search and rescue mission that they want to do. But Pike, at many points in this episode, makes the case that they can do these two concurrently. Like, they're a fully complemented ship. They can do both.
Ash, we have like hundreds of people aboard. Like, we don't need all of them to be scraping through this ship wreckage.
Right.
Especially given the fact that we haven't been able to find a single piece of the probe.
Yeah, that's kind of a creep show, right?
Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Thinking about that probe, something just hit me. It was so much bigger when it came back through the time butthole, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Like, that's not something that got fired, like at that scale, not something that realistically got fired from the shuttle. I don't know if we saw it before. Weird.
Yeah. Hard to grok the scale of things because something, so much of it, it has to do with the perspective forced on the viewer by these compositions, right?
Right, yeah, the computer graphics. But, like, we saw the thing with its tentacles grabbing the shuttle, and we get to see the instant replay of that in this episode on Tilly's screen when she's showing Tyler what she's working on. And it's big. It's very big compared to the shuttle.
I like that they dialed back Tilly a little bit in this episode. She's a little less quippy, but she's more physically comedic.
Yeah.
Like, with her looking around her screen and her description of her office. Like, I think that I like her this way better than as Simile school teacher, you know?
Yeah, and the fact that she's not just calling attention to herself, like she's actually doing a bunch of work in this episode.
I mean, when you really think about it, most members of this ship's senior staff have been through something crazy traumatic.
Yeah.
And have returned to duty more or less unscathed outside of Culber.
Right.
I mean, Tilly maybe being one of the primary examples of this.
Yeah, she was covered in goo.
Yeah, and rebuilt from her own DNA.
Was she?
Yeah, they used her own DNA in the cocoon to rebuild her.
I think they used Culber's DNA.
Well, that would be weird.
I don't know. I think that they're a little vague on that subject. One thing that they're not vague on in this episode is what happened to Ash Tyler, maybe for the first time.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, Stamets and Culber have like a bad couple's date in their apartment, where Stamets is trying to like make the case for like maybe going on some vacation together, maybe trying to spend some time reconnecting, and Culber basically has like a full blown freak out on him where he like knocks a bunch of bread rolls off a tray and calls Stamets on what he's doing, which is just kind of like...
I've got to correct you there, Ben. There's no fucking way Culber's eating carbs. He's pretty shredded, I think we know.
I didn't say he ate them. I said he knocked them off a tray.
That's why he's so insulted.
Maybe he was just going to do that anyways.
You don't know me, Stamets.
I don't eat this crap. Look at these arms.
You looking to fight the sniffles or match your pump?
I get the sense that like his senses and his body feel very disconnected from his memories. Like, he doesn't have feelings of nostalgia for things in his past. And that includes his love for Paul Stamets.
This is such a great conflict because it pays off what we have seen from the start. Like, no one has listened to Culber. He has said this the entire time. And it finally, like, reaches the point of explosion with Stamets. And it's unfortunate because we love Stamets and we don't want to see him hurt. But Stamets is the greatest defender of this.
Yeah.
He hasn't been listening to Culber.
He has made the return of his husband all about him.
Right. And I'm with Culber in this argument. Like, fucking listen or get out. But Colbert flips over a tray and then basically heads straight to the mess hall, spoiling for a fight.
And fight he gets. He kicks over Ash Tyler's table, actually knocking some piece of it off so you can see the plywood that they made the table out of. And they just have a full-blown, remade human fight in the dining hall.
I love that Culber is doing this to, awaken Voke. You know, Ash apologizes, and Ash says that wasn't me. That was the white Klingon within. And Culber's wake him up. It's a real, trying to beat up Bruce Banner to turn him into the Hulk situation.
Yeah.
I loved it. I love this.
Yeah.
The internal logic of this fight is, it hangs together perfectly.
And I also really liked learning, one way that it doesn't work in terms of what makes Ash Tyler Voke and Voke Ash Tyler, but not, he's not the Hulk, you know? He's not going to Voke out.
Right.
If he gets angry, that's not the mechanism. So,
yeah, I like that. That's a mistaken presupposition by Culber. It's such a logical leap for him to make, and that it was wrong is also a great payoff to his inclination here.
And the payoff of the fight is basically them kind of realizing that they have a lot in common as people who aren't exactly who they think of themselves as.
Yeah, it's a great end to the scene. It makes me wonder if their similarities are going to lead to a greater understanding or appreciation between them.
Yeah.
Because I could see Stamets being a little miffed at that starting to take bloom, right?
Right. Yeah. The one thing that is crazy about this scene, it does not go uncommented on, which is that Saru is let them fight it out, guys. they got to get this out of their systems. And then the next scene is Pike chewing Saru out for this.
Hardly an example of by-the-book conflict resolution.
And Saru's whoa, yeah, show me in the rule book where it says I have to intervene if a human with Klingons grafted to his bones gets in a fight with a zombie. which is a nice argument if you're persuaded by sophistry. But, you know, not actually a smart way to run a crew if you're the first officer.
Yeah, that's the point that Pike makes. This scene also makes a greater point that every single senior staff member has a fucked up backstory. And I kind of don't like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on TNG, almost everyone was an orphan in one way or another, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's true, but God, from Pike and his weird past with Talos to Saru and his loss of Ganglia to Ash and his Voke within, all the way down, everyone hasn't just been through some shit, they've almost been someone else.
Interesting that that's what the theme would be for this era.
Yeah.
We kind of can't escape who we once were now, People who made one shitty comment on Twitter in 2007, suddenly that becoming a issue in their political career or whatever.
Or these characters being something else in another television series.
Right.
Hold on, the eighth page of your film studies paper is just printing out now, Ben. Wow, you got two in this episode. Nice.
Yeah, it's cool that you have that dot matrix printer to print that out with.
Yeah.
Which is not to say, I'm not trying to say that people who said shitty stuff on Twitter should get a pass or whatever, but just that the idea of identities that haunt you is
right.
a very au courant idea, I think.
Yeah. A very modern television trope.
Yeah. In this elevator scene with Pike and Saru, Saru says that thing about a human with a Klingon grafted onto his bones. And I was could we have just gotten that phrase in fucking season one? Like, why did it take so long to get a non-vague description of what happened?
I mean, if you start a stopwatch with the beginning of that statement and then stop it at the end, I mean, what are we talking about? 4 seconds?
Yeah.
Could
put
have
it
been
in
done.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
In fact, we could probably take that audio and, like, put it in while Saru is facing away from the camera in some episode of season one and just have that in there.
You know what would make a great nickname for Ash Tyler, Ben? Bones.
Laurel dumped me. All I got in the divorce was my bones.
Yeah. This is a great hair episode for Ash Tyler, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
God.
So lank and wet.
What's the longest you've ever grown your hair?
Not even close to this long.
Really? In junior high, there was a time where I definitely had like skater parted hair that went down like to the hole in my ears. Like,
wow.
Like hung that low. But I couldn't quite make it totally to the Michael Landon phase where it started to feather back out again. In many ways, like I quit at its most ugly. I should have just seen it through.
That's pretty much what I've done every time I've tried to grow a mustache or a beard. So.
And that's what I'm saying. It's my beard growing problem. I get 2 weeks in and I just give up. I can't deal with it. Or I'm forced to give up, let's be honest.
There's something that you have to power through that it's either uncomfortable or terrible looking to get either thing, you know?
Yeah.
So on Talos IV, we get two different scenes from Spock's memory that the Talosians show Michael. They're like psionically linking the two of them together so that she can see two things. And one of the things is the apparition of the Red Angel to Spock as a boy. And this is amidst the episode where Michael Burnham ran away from home. And the Red Angel showed Spock a vision of Michael Burnham getting devoured by a giant, terrifying monster in the forest.
I have got big, big problems with the logical underpinnings of the inhabitants of Vulcan. If they allow this forest creature to live, like, right in the green belt that's connected to their backyard. What are they doing?
I mean, there's bears and wolves and stuff on Earth.
This is a wolf the size of a building. This is not right. They need to hunt these things.
Maybe this apex predator is critical to Vulcan ecology, and like the whole ecosystem would collapse if they hunted these guys to extinction. You don't know.
I don't understand this. The Red Angel's like, hey, you don't want this to happen, do you? And so young Spock warns his parents.
So then years later, he gets the vision that these squid probe devices that we have met already are part of some plan to destroy all sentient life in the galaxy. So we get to watch as a bunch of probes like slam into planets and explode them.
It's looking pretty bad for life in the galaxy.
Right. And it is sold as this is one possible future.
Spock tries to meld with it.
Yeah, Spock puts his my mind to your mind up to the helmet of the Red Angel, and I guess it didn't work because it's got like shielding, but it could like admit some thoughts through the helmet. Is that how you understood that?
I thought it was pretty interesting how you saw Michael in that scene.
Right.
And the way it was edited was presented in such a way that you weren't exactly sure if the Talosians were putting Michael in place of Spock in the scene, or if they put her in the place of the Red Angel.
Yeah, it's a little bit vague.
Yeah.
And I think intentionally so.
Yep.
The other vision that she gets to see is Spock breaking out of his mental health care facility.
He got this whole escape thing worked out, and he just got so excited.
In the padded wall room, he has been writing equations and notes about the vision he's had. And he actually interacts with Michael Burnham in this scene, and she's like, hey, listen, I'm like really worried about the fact that you've been accused of murdering these people. And he really takes that personally. He's like, did you see me murder somebody? You're in my head. You know I'm innocent.
Ben, if I'm going to write a film studies paper about this episode, mine is going to...
Oh, you too?
Mine's going to be about the similarities between Culber and Spock and how their closest friends and family don't believe them. Because the umbrage that Spock takes with his sister in this scene feels a lot like Culber's early
on. I read it a little differently. I read it as she does believe him, but she is speaking for, like, people believe you did a murder, and he is reacting to her even, like, suggesting that that would be the case, you know? Like,
well, that makes my paper the B-minus paper it is, and yours the A paper.
Yes! In your face!
The doctor comes into this scene, and she's like, all of these etchings into your floor have turned out to be premonitions, so I'm going to change my diagnosis. Good for you. And Spock, after hearing this, is like, I'm going to change the amount I want to remain in your psychiatric facility. And quickly neck pinches them, like the fastest neck pinches we've maybe ever seen in Star Trek.
This is a scene I've been eager to see since we saw the trailers for this show, because they have shown Spock kicking butt a couple of times, and I was glad to finally see it.
Yeah, you probably piss your pants when you've been neck pinched, right? I think I am almost positive that's what happens.
Yeah, I mean, some actors choose to Brando when they have to depict being neck pinched, and that's sort of a lesser form of Brandoing.
Have you ever been KO'd? Have we talked about this on the show?
I have passed out, but I've never been knocked out.
When you passed out, did you piss yourself?
No, thank goodness. Yeah. I was in my mom's godmother's house. That would have been terrible.
Were you self-defense passing out from like a family dinner or something?
No, I was like, we were there visiting, and I remember I was upstairs on a bed reading a book, and they like called me down to dinner, and I got up from the bed, and I was just, I think I was like, my heartbeat had slowed so much because I was very relaxed in this bed reading this book, and that when I stood up, I just like didn't have enough blood in my head, and I just woke up on the floor.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it was weird. I mean, I had like slightly, I had kind of like low average blood pressure when I was a kid. So don't worry, it's high average now.
It's the only thing that registers as high in any sort of clinical test of you, right?
Yeah.
Everything else, very low.
Yeah. Low T. Ooh, very low T.
Lowercase T. After the conversation that Pike and Saru have to post-game the fight, Vina visits Pike in his ready room, and he is destroyed by her, like her presence. Like, this is a great, great moment of acting for Anson Mount, I think, who has, for all of his cocksuredness and, you know, like Southwestern cowboy mentality, he is like, he reads as damaged immediately when she appears.
This is real.
As real as it needs to be.
He misses her.
Yeah.
And not having, I mean, I think we will very likely be visiting the episodes of TOS that this references at some point in the future on this show. But I think even without having seen any of that stuff, like the pathos that he brings to this scene is very, very evocative. And
I love having not seen those episodes. Like, I don't regret it. I think this is, I think that's what makes the scene better than what it would be.
Well, it's like that, you know, I love like the thought experiment of this, like not showing the earlier episodes, because like it's something that I really admire about like Blade Runner and Star Wars and like some other science fiction things, where like the movie starts and the entire universe, like they've spent so much time imagining what this world is going to look and feel like that it just feels real, you know? Yeah. Like, and Blade Runner is like the quintessential example of this. It is just like so fucking insanely atmospheric, and like every character seems to have, you know, like all the like people that work at the police station that Deckard has history with, but it's just something that comes out in their performance and in a couple of the lines, you know. It's not like we got like a last time on Blade Runner when that movie started.
There's a demonstration of grief that Pike puts on display here that is as acute as the grief that Michael Burnham and Spock show for each other, that is almost equivalent to what Stamets and Culber are going through. The idea that Pike is happy and surprised to see her, and yet grieves not being with her, and yet is also grateful that she is living out her life with a version of him. Like, this all happens with such expediency.
Yeah.
This is a really well done scene.
All right, I'm gonna move my paper up to A, maybe even A+ with this one.
Okay.
Maybe. With all these painful memories and past identities that people are having such a hard time escaping, pretty apt that the title of the episode is If Memory Serves.
Boy, if memory serves, why can't I get a refill of my coffee?
So Vina connects Pike in the second double room meetup of the season, puts Pike in connection with Michael Burnham and Spock and the Talosians. Michael Burnham has some great news. Spock did not do any murders. So that's pretty cool. The bad news is I had to break out of Section 31 with Spock because Leland was going to use some clip show devices on him. And you know how much everybody hates clip shows. So really glad we avoided that.
Where are the bodies? If he didn't kill those three people, like, where are they?
Yeah.
Did Section 31 disappear them?
Did Section 31 go down there and kill them and then go, Spock killed these guys? Like, is it a frame job? But what the way Michael Burnham says it is there weren't any murders in the first place.
Right. Yeah.
So that makes me think not. Although I guess you wouldn't be privy to anything that happened after Spock left at this point.
Michael has a ton of exposition to get out in this scene. As you said, Spock's innocent. Section 31 tried to clip show him. Also, we need you to drive Disco here right now because the Red Angel has a plan for us. And Spock's like, yeah, no time to tell you what that plan is, but there is one.
Take it on faith, he says. Yeah. Didn't think those words would ever fly out of his mouth.
Right. And so the fastest way to get from point A to point B is a spore jump, Ben. And so the Disco readies itself for that.
Yes. And this is something that happens right on the heels of Dr. Culber essentially dumping Stamets. Like, Stamets has just gotten dumped, and the black alert thing chimes through the ship.
I'm going to go ahead and put this in the correct prediction column for Adam.
Oh, yeah.
I think I saw this one coming.
Yeah. I mean, it's felt like it's been coming.
Yeah.
Here it is. Yeah. Very sad. Do you want to make another prediction about whether or not they patch it up by the end of the season?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to say no.
Wow.
I think this is a permanent thing, more or less.
I'll take the bet.
Okay.
So, do you want to say, like, by the end of this season, you're saying they definitely don't patch it up, and I'm saying they definitely do, or
right,
are on their way, or, like, you know, definitively looking like they're on their way to.
Yeah, I mean, the bet is on definition. Anything squishy would just be a draw.
Right. Okay. So, what are the stakes? What do you get if you're right?
Look, if past episodes of season two are any indication, we are not going to know the payoff of this until many, many episodes from now.
How about this? Whoever's wrong has to do a power hour on a future episode of The Greatest Discovery.
Fine. Fine.
Okay. Hold us to it, listeners. We'll probably forget we said all this.
Before we leave this scene behind, I just wanted to talk briefly about its emotional gravity. This felt like something that was written from personal experience. And I think you and I have been here before. Like, breakups can take many forms. And I think a form of breakup that is familiar to me, and this can come from either direction, is like there's an impulse to bargain in that moment that you see Stamets try to do here. Like, he tries to pump the brakes on the finality of this in a way that is tragic and familiar to, I think, a lot of people who have been either broken up with or who have broken up with someone. And it grounds this moment in not a science fiction future, but in a contemporary, this is what breakups feel like kind of way. And I think that is what makes me feel something when I see it. I thought this was well acted and well written.
We get to see the entire Kubler-Ross model of breaking up.
Yeah. Yeah.
The spore drive, no work, seems to be that somebody threw some wooden shoes into the spore drive. They can tell that, at least. Ash Tyler, like, comes onto the bridge and goes, like, why are we going to Black Alert? And he gets the download on what they're about to do. I wondered in this moment, like, Ash Tyler walks onto the bridge and asks for an update a lot. What is he doing when he's not on the bridge?
It would seem as though he, I mean, if Leland's his boss, he doesn't have to directly report to him hour by hour.
Yeah, I guess he has a lot of free time. Maybe he's catching up on his reading.
Hmm.
So it is in this moment that the hammer drops on Ash Tyler, because Saru and the security lady that Pike brought with him have built a case that Ash Tyler sent a bunch of illicit transmissions from the ship and may in fact have sabotaged the spore drive. And so he gets escorted off the bridge, and then the camera pans down to Arium's feet, and she only has one of her two wooden shoes on.
You're talking about her sabot.
Yeah, she's usually wearing some sabot,
right.
But she only has one of them today.
Mm.
And nobody's like, Arium, where's your other sabot?
Couldn't help but notice you're walking with a limp. Yeah, Ash is a great mark in this scene.
Yeah, he seems so guilty.
Yeah.
In fact, if somebody else hadn't done it, he probably would have done it.
Right. That's what makes this feel so real. And so Pike orders him taken to the brig and pulls his badge right off of him, because he's smart, because his badge is also a communicator.
Yeah.
Pike also wonders if Ash has been subjected to a clip show device. So there's like a fair amount of humanity shown to him. Like, look, man, you could have done this intentionally, but maybe it's not your fault. And that's okay, too. We're just going to put you in the brig.
A surprising amount of arrogant denial from Ash when that's suggested. He's like, no, that's the old me. It's like, dude, if you were able to kill Culber before, you should know that this is like a distinct possibility in this world.
Yeah, he's got to believe this on some level, but he does not betray that to the rest of the bridge crew.
I just want to correct you so that we don't get emails. He was confined to his quarters, not taken to the brig.
Thanks. My paper is now a C.
Looks like you're not going to be making Dean's List this semester, Adam.
So they got to slum it, Ben. They got to take the disco at regular ass warp.
Gross.
To Starbase 11. And then the plan is like halfway through to hang a right and head to Talos.
I pictured it as a right as well.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know why that would be. But yeah, so they head to Talos. And Section 31 is actually like hot on their heels, so it's a bit of a race. Michael Burnham and Spock, who is now much better, are going to leave the planet, but first the Talosians need to square up with Michael Burnham. They're not going to let her leave without giving them what they're due, which is this painful memory. And so
they wheel out the giant glass coffee table. They roll up underneath it.
Like, oh, they changed out of their robes and now they're in like weird latex gear.
They give Michael Burnham like kind of a lot of Gatorade.
I mean, it's kind of pointless to put a ball gag on a Talosian because they can speak to you with just their mind, right?
What they need is a mental ball gag.
Yeah, yeah. What's your mental safe word? But the memory that she shares is of the thing that we've been dying to learn about, which is the life event that drove the wedge between Michael Burnham and Spock. And I was a little surprised by this. It doesn't seem like something that they couldn't get past with just a couple of conversations about it.
Oh, Ben, that is spoken like an only child. I'm sorry, dude. I'm sorry to have to lay that on you, but yeah, man, like I could feel this.
Really?
I've had arguments with my brother that go this direction. I've been estranged from family members before. This felt real. Like when you know exactly the button to push on someone. And here's the thing, like here's what makes this scene work is that all we've seen from young Spock up until now was his distrust of his sister, his adopted sister. And what we get in this episode is that he has turned the corner and that he loves her.
Yeah.
Like this is an entire episode that shows up until now the love that young Spock had for young Michael Burnham, and
right.
the way that she decides to betray that, knowing how difficult it was for him to go there with her. I think.
Right, but she's betraying it, that love, to protect him.
Yeah, but
the thing that I did not understand the first time I watched this episode was, after having experienced that memory, why Spock couldn't see that she was doing something that was hard for her and that hurt him in order to protect him. And then on the rewatch, I realized like Spock is not watching this memory. This is just between Michael Burnham and the Talosians.
Well, Ben, you might be seeing my film studies paper print out on your end.
It's just coming through now in the teletype.
Because that new one is about how the currency between family members is emotional and not logical, and that there was no way for him to grasp this in a logical fashion because that's not how families work, and that's not the currency that family members exchange with each other.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, if they had let him in on this and seen this all from her perspective, she would have realized that it was not, that it was like a bad decision, but it was done out of love and it was done for the right reasons, just in the wrong way.
This is something that she expresses at the very end of the episode. Like she gets those words out.
Yeah. And then we get a little standoff in orbit as the ship that Leland captains and the Discovery. I wish we knew the name of that ship.
It's the USS Leland.
Is it really?
That's what I'm calling it.
Fucking egotistical bastard. Giorgio's going to sneak out in the middle of the night and paint her name over that. But we get a little standoff between them. And they both want to be the ones that beam up Spock and Michael Burnham. No discussion of the shuttle being recovered in this situation. I guess Pike is just trying to grab him and get out of there. But it's like it's a standoff. They've both got transporter lock, and if they both try to engage it, they'll just fly apart at the molecular level. So Pike actually gets a final Vena visit, where she kind of convinces him to let it go. And this like theme of like you're gonna have to trust Michael Burnham, something that Ash Tyler even makes the case for. You're going to have to trust Spock, something that Spock makes the case for, and now Vena is making the case for. Like, he relents and just lets it go. She could have told him, like, oh, they're going to sneak up in the shuttle after Section 31 bounces. Don't worry about it. Instead, she says, let your friends go.
awkward.
She also loves drama.
Yeah.
Like, but like Aristotelian drama.
She loves drama like TNT.
Yeah. The Section 31 ship thinks that they've got them. They bug out, and Michael Burnham and Spock return to the Discovery on the shuttlecraft. They have all really pissed off Starfleet now. Like, Leland leaves and says, like, go report to Starbase 11 for your court-martials, everybody. But the fact that also Michael Burnham and Spock are now aboard the Discovery, like, Pike feels the need to, like, do that captain speech of, like, we are now completely, completely working against the wishes of Starfleet. Anybody that wishes to, like, leave the bridge, you know, it'll be in the captain's log that you actually followed orders, unlike the rest of us.
I fucking love that Detmer cuts Pike off at the beginning of that speech. Like,
yeah.
Obedience.
Course heading, sir. Does feel like we should get moving.
That's a show starting to become self-aware about its preachiness.
Right.
I think it's great.
Fun.
I like that it was Detmer, too.
She was cool.
Yeah, can I interest you in a fugitive ship story? Because that is what we appear to be getting.
It is so wild. Like, you get this moment where the ship kind of pulls out of orbit and warps off, like classic, like TNG end of show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we started with a captain's log, we ended with the ship warping out of the system.
Yeah.
And it looks like it is setting up like that. You use that moment to imagine what the future of the show is, and its Discovery is on the run from Starfleet the entire time. And then we get a vasectomy that shows something quite the opposite. But maybe we'll save that for that segment of the show. Do you want to talk about whether you liked this episode?
Yeah, we do have a format, Ben.
Yeah, I don't want to break it.
This is the first episode that I have liked in, I think, the last three that I liked wholeheartedly. And I think that's for a couple of reasons. This feels like the first time in quite a while that, like, the crew's previous actions have actually created consequences for them that they're dealing with right now. No longer are they just setting off time bombs in the orbit above Kaminar and then, like, leaving the planet to deal with it. Like, the shit that Michael Burnham and Spock did as kids are coming back to haunt them. The stuff that Pike did on Talos 4 is coming back to haunt him. Like, shit is coming home to roost. The stuff between Stamets and Culber, it's all coming back. And I wish that this show sprinkled this a little more evenly over the season.
Yeah.
Like, that's what's unfortunate to me, is that this was possible.
The show could get to all of these things and spent the last three episodes kind of fumble fucking around not getting to them.
Right. But, man, strong episode. And I think maybe, if not the best episode of season two to me, in my mind. What about you, Ben?
Yeah, I really liked it too. I had fun watching it, and that, like, realization toward the end that Spock wasn't actually privy to the painful memory that Michael Burnham shares with the Talosians was really cool to like come across that thought the second time through.
Right.
Because you get the kind of rules of these, like, shared memories at the beginning of the episode, and the fact that the rules change at the end being something that's non-obvious and something that's kind of there for you to notice feels really, like, strong and confident writing. And it's a fun app. It's a fun app that makes, like, weird, interesting, strong choices that are not the weird, interesting, strong choices that Disco has made previously, and I really like it.
Me too.
Adam, you want to see if we have any Priority One messages in the inbox?
Oh, we got to do that.
Yeah.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Adam, we have a couple of Priority One messages today. The first is from David, and it's to Camille. Goes like this. Happy birthday. It's been an amazing 15 years of marriage.
Wow.
I've loved every minute with you. And every time we've watched all the Star Trek series, minus that weird cartoon from the 70s. I can't wait for the next 15 more years together. We're like Rashaan and Kevin Uxbridge, Kes, Neelix, Tasha Yar and Data, T'Pol and Trip, Isolinear Chips and Jim Shimoda?
I don't know who those other people are.
That's weird, Kevin, because you're all powerful, and yet you don't seem to have a curious imagination. You're not, like, looking into things and trying to get to know the world around you.
I don't have eyes for other women. I'm totally focused on my wife, Rashaan.
All right. Well, I mean, that's fair. She's a lovely lady and makes a hell of a cup of tea, so I can imagine you feel totally satisfied.
You can go ahead and window shop. That's up to you.
Let me just pitch something to you, though, Kevin, because this is not, technically not the original Rashaan. And, like, don't you think that the lady you loved would want you to be happy, would want you to move on, you know? Like, vengeance and then, like, trying to recreate something from the past for yourself just doesn't seem like a healthy way of coping with grief.
What is this, fucking therapy?
Yeah, I'm kind of doctor filling you, Kevin.
Wow, 15 years, Ben. That's awesome. I just had my 5-year anniversary. And wow, 15 is a great achievement. So good job by them.
Yeah, good job, Camille and David. And happy birthday, Camille.
Ben, our second priority one message is from Stupid Shark. It is for Empress Mo. The message goes like this: happy birthday to my fellow viewer and sister.
Wow.
Message continues: thanks for being so cool, finding all drunk Shimodas in life, including my wedding, and having the weirdest memories together. Let's keep singing Stinky Diaper Commander Riker and wondering about the TOS thruple. Here's to a great next year.
Wow. Happy birthday, Empress Mo.
Yeah. Happy day, Empress Mo. Well done.
Couple of birthdays. This is great.
They make up songs just like you, Ben.
Yeah. I mean, you've made up a song or two.
I mean, you're the true songsman of Uxbridge Shimoda. Come on.
I don't know about that. I feel like we share that distinction. But I can only aspire to coming up with gold like Stinky Diaper Commander Riker.
Hey, I'm really grateful for 2 Priority One messages on this episode of Greatest Discovery.
Yeah, if you'd like to send a Priority One message, head to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It is $100 for a personal message and $200 for a commercial message, and we really appreciate it.
We do an embarrassing Star Trek podcast, and a big part of our success is owning that, being ourselves in all our embarrassing glory. But what if we didn't? What if we were just a Star Trek podcast? No embarrassment, no comedy, just Star Trek podcast. If you're somebody who wants a website, you could go generic and bland and one size fits all on a social media platform, or you could buy a custom URL and design a custom website with Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform for all kinds of people to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. So whoever you are, or whatever you're trying to do, own it with Squarespace. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/trek to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
It's Webby season. Hi, I'm Sequoia Holmes, host of the Black People Love Paramore podcast. And we are nominated for a Webby for the episode where I interviewed Hayley Williams. In case you're unfamiliar, Black People Love Paramore is a podcast delving into the common and uncommon interests of Black people in order to help us feel more seen. We would love your vote to help us win this Webby. Please take a second and go over to the Black People Love Paramore podcast social media accounts, and you can find them at BPLP Pod across all social media platforms. Hit the link in bio and vote for Black People Love Paramore.
Hi, I'm Travis McElroy.
And I'm Teresa McElroy.
And we're the host of Schmanners.
We don't believe that etiquette should be used to judge other people.
No, on Schmanners, we see etiquette as a way to navigate social situations with confidence.
So if that sounds like something you're into,
join us every Friday on Maximum Fun, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Ben.
What's that, Adam?
Did you discover yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible!
Drunk Shimoda!
I did. They first show up at Talos IV, and it looks to be a black hole that is going to destroy their shuttle. And Michael Burnham goes through all of the emotions that one would expect to go through when they are certain they're going to die. And then when the illusion dissipates and it becomes clear that they are not going to die, she kind of like expositions what just happened to them and then says like, boy, we're really on the other side of the looking glass now. And the camera cuts to Spock who rolls his eyes as if to say, Christ, not another fucking Alice in Wonderland reference. Jesus, again?
I love that.
And it really made me laugh. I thought it was like maybe a bit of directing that was like, I think that this could both serve story purpose, but also make a little bit of fun of all of the Alice in Wonderland stuff.
Yeah.
So that's my drunk Shimoda. Spock, how about yourself?
I love that the show is beginning to roll its eyes at itself. And my Shimoda is going to go to Georgiou for a scene that resembles that remark. When Leland beams up what he thinks to be Burnham and Spock and like gets all cocksure about the interrogation to come, he's like, I'll do the talking. They cut to a close-up of Emperor Georgiou, and the take that Michelle Yeoh gives in this moment has like three steps to it. What she does with her eyes to register her incredulity about this is great. Like, it has to be re-seen to be really appreciated, but I think she's doing a ton of great subtle work. Like, for someone who sort of has the rep of, like, Hong Kong action hero, she does a lot when she's not fighting, and her acting should be appreciated for the moments when she's not. She is really great in the show.
Yeah, she is the best. We're lucky to have her.
Yeah.
Even if her character isn't that well-written.
What do we have coming up on the next episode, Ben?
So, as I said before, like, you kind of leave the meat of this episode expecting that they're going to be, like, running as far away and as fast as they can from Section 31. The vasectomy we are shown, however, is of them showing up at Section 31 headquarters and getting in a big space fight with blade mines, and then Arium kicking everybody's butt on some kind of away mission.
Yeah. Arium, not an away team veteran at this point, I would say.
No. First timer, maybe.
Yeah. That's not going to turn out great.
Yeah. She's kicking everybody's butt.
I wonder if these mines aren't set to defend against people coming to Section 31 headquarters and are instead the threat to Section 31 headquarters.
Wow.
That's what I think. That's my prediction.
They do have the same color signifiers as the squid that attacked the shuttle, so maybe you're right.
They got to save Admiral Bob, though. It sure seems like that's where she is, right?
Got to save Bob.
Have any predictions for the episodes ahead, Ben?
No, I've been too wrong too much of the time, and I'm staring down the barrel of a power hour now, so...
Oh.
I'm gonna hold my predictions.
Fair enough. Well, let's give the episode to Rob, then.
Yeah, take it away, Rob. Oh, before we do, though, we should say next week is the beginning of the Max Fun Drive, so if you like The Greatest Discovery and want to see it go forward, the Max Fun Drive is the best time of year to become a monthly member, and we'd really appreciate a lot of our new listeners choosing to do that. So starting March 18th, I believe.
Yeah, that's the best time to support the shows you love on the Max Fun Network, and we sure hope you love The Greatest Discovery, because Ben and I love making it.
Yeah, So get ready for that. We're really looking forward to it, and we really appreciate everybody that supports already. Okay, take it away, Rob.
The Greatest Discovery is a Maximum Fun podcast hosted by Adam Pranica and Ben Harrison, and it's produced and edited by me, Rob Schulte. Our theme music is by Adam Ragusea. Head on over to MaximumFun.org/donate to support the ongoing production of our show. And a nice free way to support the show is to head on over to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and review. You can find Ben on Twitter at BenjaminAHR, Adam is at CutForTime, and I'm at Rob K. Schulte. All right, thanks. We'll see you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.